You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
One of the most terrifying scenes in Stephen King's The Shining is when we discover that instead of writing his novel, Jack Torrance has been typing the phrase, "All work and no play make Jack a dull boy," over and over, and we realize that he's insane. Thankfully, that hasn't happened to Stephen King, who's written 60 books and approximately 400 short stories so far. He's also the editor of this year's The Best American Short Stories, published by Houghton Mifflin. It is my great pleasure to welcome Stephen King back to the show. Hi.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Now, you've been on the show twice, once when you were doing a fundraiser for a friend who'd been in a motorcycle accident, and once when you won the National Book Award, but never to promote one of your own books. Mm-hmm. In this case, you're publicizing this collection. Is it because you care so much about the fate of the short story?
I do care about the fate of the short story, and that was one reason to do it. I also had a selfish reason to do it. I wanted to reacquaint myself with the short story landscape. And I also thought, way down in my heart, I've sort of fallen away from writing short stories, and maybe if I reacquaint myself with what's going on right now, I'll be reinvigorated and want to write them, because I've really never lost my taste for them, and it would be sad to feel like a skill you once had had slipped away.
Well, it's obviously something of a cause for you. You wrote an end paper in the New York Times Book Review lamenting the state of the short story. Do you think it's a dying form because few mainstream publications seem to want to publish them anymore?
I think that that's part of it, but it's very difficult to actually parse out the root cause. I think some of it is an ingrown laziness in the American reading public, where the number of adventurous readers who are willing to try a short story by a newcomer, that those people have shrunk. I sometimes kid people and say that TV programs like American Idol have made the cultural landscape safe for mediocrity. I think that where there was a time when I was a kid and the Saturday Evening Post would come and I'd look at the contents page and say, "Oh man, a new short story by Gerald Kirsch. I can't wait to read that and see if it's as good as Men Without Bones or some of the other ones that I'd read." That doesn't happen anymore because the market isn't there.
And in that case, a lot of those short stories wound up being made into movies. And so we had that process, one thing enriching the other. Mm-hmm. We've had a few cases like that. Brokeback Mountain was from a short story.
It was
Annie
from
Proulx.
A short story. It was in the New Yorker. And I actually came in at the very end of the magazine thing as a writer. My novel, Salem's Lot, was condensed in Cosmopolitan, and I can't imagine anything like that happening today because it would get in the way of 10 sex secrets every young woman should know.
And what he won't tell you.
That's right. 10 ways to make him scream after midnight.
But it's interesting that it was...
Which is fiction, in a way, when you think about it.
Those are the real short stories of today. But when you look at the one magazine, mainstream magazine, that consistently publishes short stories, The New Yorker, and then you look at what these short stories are all about, often they are chapters from novels. So we're seeing, there still are some pretty great short story writers out there, but we're seeing more and more of an assault on the short story.
We are, I think, and I wrote in my introduction that was excerpted in the Times Book Review that one of the real clear ways that you can see this is if you want these magazines, they're there at the chain bookstores, but you have to look in most cases on the very bottom shelf to find them below the hi-fi magazines. I mean, there's a great story in this week's New Yorker by T. Karasen Boyle. We're doing this thing at Symphony Space tonight, and one of the stories that they're going to read in a kind of dramatic fashion by T. Karasen Boyle in the New Yorker called Sin Dollar. And I read it because I like the story so much that's in our book.
And he's a fabulous short story writer.
He's a terrific short story writer. And one of the things that I wondered in reading it, again, you have to see these things symbolically. There is still fiction in The New Yorker, but you always find it in the very back of the book, not in what the magazine editorial staff calls the well of the book. There's something that's peripheral that's toward the end. And I read it and I thought to myself, I wonder how many people who pick up The New Yorker actually read these short stories. And in some ways, it's a question you don't want answered.
Actually, a lot of New Yorkers do because they're perfect for subway rides. But looking over the contributors to the book that you've done, the Best American Short Stories, any number of the authors are better known as novelists. Richard Russo, John Barth, Mary Gordon, T. Corragison Boyle, Louis Auchincloss. One of the only exceptions is Alice Munro, who resists like mad writing a novel, although she has written some short stories that, if you put them all together, turn out to be the equivalent of a novel.
Right. Well, there are writers out there who, so far as I know, have done few, if any, novels. We don't have a short story in here this time by Harlan Ellison, the science fiction writer, but he's somebody who hasn't really done a novel since 1956, and that was a short one. So there are a few. But the thing is, as far as our national literary consciousness goes, it's pretty much attuned to the novel now. And that's one reason why I wanted to try and reacquaint myself with the short story, because it's so below the radar now.
So when Heidi Pittler asked you to be the guest editor this year, you said yes.
Oh, I said yes like a shot.
Stephen King is my guest. He is the editor of this year's The Best American Short Stories, which is published by Houghton Mifflin. The series has been around for quite a while and been one of the most successful short story series. But, you know, it's interesting in the story you tell about the first short story you wrote, your mother paid for it, but then she encouraged you to expand it. So even then there was pressure to make short stories into something larger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, she used to pay me a quarter a short story, and I think it was because it kept me out of her hair when she was trying to vacuum or wash the clothes or whatever it was. I was very quiet up in my room when I was doing that.
So if your mother hadn't just wanted to keep you out of her way, you might not have become a writer?
No, I think I probably would have. You're like a compass needle, and sooner or later you come near true north and the needle swings. So I think sooner or later it would have called me. The first story that I ever wrote for money was something that was a novelization about 16 pages long of a horror movie, The Pit and the Pendulum. So in a way, I was novelizing something that had been changed from a short story by a guy I didn't even know of called Edgar Allan Poe, and I sold it at my grammar school, and I was suspended from school because the material was so horrible.
Oh, I thought because they were accusing you of plagiarism, but probably by the time it had gotten to you through the movie, the filter of all those different things, it was a different story anyway.
It was totally different.
You said in the New York Times that most short stories aren't written for a readership, but for an audience of editors and teachers. Mm-hmm. You think that's really true?
I actually do, because I think very little. First of all, let's look at it this way. Let's say here's in a circle, here's the whole American public, and then a smaller circle, those who can read, much smaller circle, those who read fiction, much, much smaller circle, those who read short fiction. And if you go out on the street and you say to somebody, do you know some of the magazines that are in the back of here, like the Little Swanee Review or Plowshares or Tin House or Glimmer Train, they'll say, huh, what's that? But if you say to somebody, do you know who Danielle Steele is? Oh, yes, she's the romance writer. Or do you know who Stephen King is? Do you know who James Patterson is? They'll say yes. But there are so many of these magazines that pay only a little bit of money. And I think, too, this is one other thing that I've noticed among the younger writers. And we've got a pretty good bouquet, use the word advisedly, of younger writers in this book, which is terrific. You find a lot of times what's happening here are people are writing short stories, aiming toward getting a collection of short stories published to establish a foothold in the publishing industry. Then they want to go on to the novel.
Well, it's interesting, I think, that your acceptance by the literary community began, as far as I can tell, when your stories began to be published in The New Yorker. You were out there, everybody said, well, he writes all of these great bestsellers, but then people started taking you seriously as a literary writer, and maybe it was the imprimatur of The New Yorker.
Well, don't get Harold Bloom in here and ask him if he takes me seriously as a literary writer, because he'll laugh.
Is Harold Bloom the arbiter of? I mean, he set himself up as the arbiter of the canon, but there are other canons, aren't there?
There are, and nobody knows who's a writer who is a quote-unquote writer of literature, writer of popular fiction, until the dust settles, which is about 40 years later.
How long did you work on this project? You must have read an awful lot of stories.
I did. This was I don't think that I've ever worked harder on a book in my life than I did on this one. I took the assignment very seriously, and one of the things that I was determined to do was to expand my view to magazines that I hadn't seen listed as sources in Best American, like Fantasy and Science Fiction, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, Alfred Hitchcock. I wanted to try to find as much online as I could. I just wanted to expand the playing field if I could and try to find stories that I liked. So I ended up reading, I can't remember how many, I think it was about 400 stories. I'm not sure. I've got them in a box, the magazines that just overflow. So I started in November of the year before, because that's when the first stories start to come out for the calendar year 2006 when we read, and finally finished up probably in January of the next year.
Well, although The Atlantic has dropped publishing short stories, those genre magazines still thrive. Science fiction, thriller magazines, adventure magazines.
No, they and don't.
They don't?
No,
we're
they
not
don't.
Getting short stories there as well?
Well, we're getting them there, and I maintain that the magazine of fantasy and science fiction is still the gold standard when it comes to short fiction in the United States of America, short popular fiction anyway. And the best of the popular fiction and literary fiction have an overlap. But and I was frankly disappointed in the mystery magazines this year. We read a few good stories. I read a few good stories. The best of them, though, were British. And even with The New Yorker now, you're seeing a lot of short story writers who are not from America, so that they're not eligible. But those magazines, like Fantasy and Science Fiction and Ellery Queen, really are existing just above the profit line. The black ink is so thin that you almost need a microscope to see it. I sold a story to FNSF late this year, and the pay for it is $500, and that's very
small. That was an act of charity in your case.
No, I won't say it's charity, because I can still buy some hot dinners for that, but $500, I would love to see it be more. I would love to be able to see them afford more, because it would mean the stories were reaching a wider reading public.
My guest is Stephen King, who's this year's guest editor of the Best American Short Stories series, the 2007 edition, published by Houghton Mifflin. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Stephen King, who is the editor of this year's edition of the Best American Short Stories series, published by Houghton Mifflin. Mr. King knows a thing or two about short stories. He's written hundreds of them, I think approximately 400 by somebody's estimation. When you looked at these stories, did you find you had to read it all the way through? Because I've been told by some people that they can generally figure out whether something is going to be okay by the first, second, even third paragraph.
I can't do it that soon. And furthermore, I have a more, I'm going to say, generous nature, so that even if it seems bad to begin with, I'm willing to give it a little more time. But if it's not doing it in a page or two, if you know that it's really bad, you just know, that's all.
Well, there's always a problem with something that's called the best. For example, Alice Munro, who's in this. Can we say that she only had one good short story last year? I mean, she probably wrote 10 good short stories last year.
No, you can't say that. That's one of the problems. I discussed this with Heidi Pitlor, who was my fearless co-editor. And believe me, when I mean that. For every story I read, Heidi must have read four or five. So she read...
She got rid of a bunch before you even looked at them.
No, that isn't necessarily true, although there were a lot I didn't have to read or didn't even see. But the thing is, Heidi told me we really ought to have only one story by a given writer because the space is so limited and we want to give exposure to as many writers as possible. But there's a lady in here named Karen Russell who wrote a story called St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. And I read three stories by her last year that I thought were just absolutely terrific stories. And in the best of all possible worlds, every one of them would have been in. She's published a book of short stories by that title, St. Lucy's Home. And it's a terrific book. So, yeah, there are, and John Barth had three stories that I read that I thought were all really terrific. But we definitely, in each case, we tried to get the best of the best.
In the case of St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, I thought that if you took her name off of it and you put Stephen King's name on it, somebody might have said, hey, sure, he could have written that.
That's very flattering to think. It's got a pointedness of wit that I rarely attain.
There are 20 stories in the collection, pretty much 20 stories in every year, so there are space limitations, but you didn't limit yourself to short ones. If anything, some of these stories are quite long.
We read whatever is called short fiction. I mean, it comes in all various lengths. It's like people. There are little ones, there are medium-sized ones where the majority are, and there are big fellas. I think that we probably tried to steer clear of what's called short novels, novellas, novelettes, just because of that space limitation. I can't remember what the longest story in the book is, but there are a couple of fairly long stories.
I think your book on writing is one of the best books ever written on the topic, and it looks to me like you've followed your own criteria. For instance, there are very few adverbs in these stories. And for another, most of them start with an interesting situation.
I like stories that take me away. And every guest editor who's ever worked on Best American Short Stories brings their own prejudices, their own likes and dislikes. I mean, the list of guest editors reads like a who's who: Margaret Atwood, Richard Ford, Salman Rushdie is working with Heidi this year. Everybody brings their own prejudices, likes, and dislikes. I like emotionally assaultive fiction. I like stories where you forget that you have to take the kids to soccer, you forget that you had a doctor's appointment, or you drag your magazine with you because you can't put that down. And a short story that does that is really remarkable because there's a time limit. It's the difference between a marathon and a 100-yard dash.
But short stories have a way, the really good ones, of grabbing you and saying, you've got to pay attention to this.
Absolutely.
And because novels can be so much more digressive. With a short story, you're just getting right into it. And one of the rules you talked about in your book was pay attention to how real people around you behave and then write the truth about what you see.
Right. And with a short story, it's almost like creating miniatures.
One of those stories is in this book, Wake by Beverly Jensen. I wonder how that story even came to be published.
Well, I think that it was her brother who got it published. It's her only published work of fiction. I think that Beverly Jensen was what you'd call a closet writer, somebody who raised her family, had a family, and in her spare time wrote in the back room. And a lot of us know people like that. Very few of them show the talent that this story does. She died, and her brother submitted the story to publication. And this is one of the few cases where I didn't find the story, and Heidi didn't find the story. I think it was the previous editor of Best American who came across the story and wrote me a letter and Heidi a letter and said, whoa, you really ought to consider this. And it's a terrific story. Well, I like it, of course, because it's a New England story, and I'm from Maine.
Well, she couldn't do something else that's in this book, but at the end, each represented author writes a paragraph, some longer, some shorter, about how they came to write their story.
Isn't that fun?
Is that something that you brought to the series?
No, I think it's been there. I would have to double check with the invaluable Heidi Pittler to be sure, but I'm sure the contributors' notes have been a part of it for a long time.
Because that's really gives another kind of insight. Some of these writers we know, we've read other things by, but others like Beverly Jensen, we've never read anything before. I hope we can read some other things. Maybe there are other things in a shoebox somewhere.
There might be. But one of the great pleasures, I think, for a guy like me, of finding people whose work you don't know but who shines. There's a story in here called Wait by Roy Kesey, about people stuck in an airport waiting lounge for days that become weeks, that become months. It's a small country, and there's a revolution outside, and paratroopers come down, and the runways get blown up, and the fog never lifts. And it's like every traveler's worst nightmare.
Eileen Pollack, in describing the process by which she wrote her story, The Bris, could be quoting from your book on writing. What's the premise of that story?
I think that the Bris is a story about we ran into any number of stories about dying parents. That was the theme for the year. Heidi says this year it's divorce and remarriage and that sort of thing. But there seem to be. It seems to be like some science fiction writer talked about when a steam engine time, somebody will invent a steam engine. But apparently, a number of writers have just gotten to the age where they're recognizing their parents' mortality. So the story is about an old Jewish man, I think, who is dying, and he has never been circumcised. And he wants to have a bris, even though he's dying of kidney cancer. And I think...
So he can be buried in a Jewish cemetery.
And the rabbi is very unbending about this. He has to be... have a bris in order to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. So the kid works up this whole plan. The story is touching and sad
and
at
funny.
The same time, it's hilarious.
Yeah. There's a hilarious scene in which he's playing tennis with the rabbi, hoping to persuade him to write the
right.
certificate.
And it's losing on purpose to put the rabbi in a good mood.
My guest is Stephen King, who has edited this year's edition of the Best American Short Stories series, published by Houghton Mifflin. Another story that will... I saw a connection to Stephen King, is William Gay's Where Will You Go When Your Skin Cannot Contain You? It's a horror story, but from real life.
Right. Well, actually, again, that's a story that I didn't find on my own, and Heidi didn't, in this case, recommend it to me. My son, Owen, who's also a writer, called me up on the phone, I think it was fairly early in the year, and said, Dad, are you editing Best American Stories this year? And I said, yeah. He said, this is incredible story by William Gay called Where Will You Go When Your Skin Cannot Contain You? And it's in Tin House, and I was still finding my way at that point. I didn't know the names of all the magazines, and I went out, I found Tin House, and again, it's a magazine that isn't read, it isn't up there with People and Cosmopolitan, but it's a beautiful magazine, has great graphics and great fiction, and I found this story, and it just knocked me out. You're right, it's a scary story.
Well, you can't imagine this in Cosmo. It's kind of difficult to read because it's such an effective depiction of people whose lives are distorted by drugs or violence.
Yeah, yeah. My wife said this is the kind of story you either love or hate.
Mm. There are people who don't want to read things that are disturbing or see movies that are disturbing, and if everyone was like that, you'd probably not be doing very well.
That's probably true. But it's an amazing thing how many people really want to experience various extremes of human behavior, from what's funny to what's horrible. And one of the nice things about a book like Best American Short Stories, and I hope all your listeners will run out and get it and support it, support the American short story, a plea that usually falls on deaf ears, by the way. But when you do, it's like a buffet meal, a really good one. And if you try this, and maybe you love it, and you go out and find more stuff by that writer, and sometimes you try something that you've never had before, and you absolutely fall in love with it.
Well, I wrote a novel once, and I think the reason that it remains in my closet, locked away so no one can see it, is because I had written more short stories to prepare myself. The novel would have been a lot better if I had developed the certain skills that you only get from writing short stories. There is a big difference, ultimately, but the short story forces you really to get to the gist of things, don't you think?
It does, but I think that what you say is very, very true and incisive. not every writer is the same, and there are writers who've written nothing but novels. One of the things that makes me a little bit sad is that we don't have a representation in this book by somebody like Elmore Leonard, who used to write short stories but apparently doesn't anymore. But for most writers, there is a progression where you almost like learn to crawl, then you learn to take a few steps, then you learn to walk, then you learn to run, so that you'll see writers graduate from the short story. My message to writers is that doesn't mean that you can't go back and that you can't continue to practice this other smaller craft. It's just as rewarding. For instance, Joyce Carol Oates has written dozens of novels. Maybe it's hundreds by now, which is kind of a mean thing to say, especially from someone who's written as many as I have. But she also writes a lot of short stories. She's never left that smaller thing behind, because it is. It's a wonderful talent. It's like putting furniture in a dollhouse.
Well, since you bring that up, I have a question for you. Your book on writing was published in the year 2000. In the author's note, it says you published more than 30 books. In the press package with this book, it says that you're the author of 60 books. So you've really written 30 books in the interim?
No, I haven't. There's something screwy about those numbers, but I don't know which side it's on. It seems to me I can't even count the number of novels, and I don't mean that to sound self-congratulatory. It's really not. I don't know how many books I've actually written, but I think the total number, because I don't even let them publish what they call an ad card anymore in the front of the books, because there's so many books on it, it's a little bit embarrassing. I would say probably around 60 books total, and probably the number in on writing is low, but that's nothing compared to somebody like, for instance, Nora Roberts, who's published like 400, and John Creasy published 600.
Does it get any easier?
No.
Does it get harder? Do you find yourself constantly challenging yourself to do things that you didn't do before?
I think so. I think you have to. It's grow or die, but it's still always a rewarding job. I mean, I can go out and work on something and just say, "That I did a horrible job today, but it was wonderful."
Do you think that people learn to write the way that you did anymore, washing laundry by day and typing away at night?
I'm sure they do. I'm sure that if you looked on the author page, the back flap of a lot of books, you'd still find many writers who have that patchwork career, worked as a postman and a game warden and this and that and the other thing.
Although a lot more probably went through some MFA program. I can't tell you how many writers I've had on the show whose work began, the novel or the short stories began while they were in some kind of graduate program.
And I think that that's true. And it's not necessarily a good thing for a writer to spend that much time in having other people examine work in progress and for you to examine the work of others in progress and spend too much of that time in analysis. Because the bottom line, Lenny, is that it's not an analytical job. It's something that comes from your heart and your head. But sometimes the worst thing you can do is to sit around and analyze and say, well, what did you mean by this? What did I mean by this? Too much of that, I think, is the death of spontaneity.
And it winds up being all about plot points and whether it can be adapted into a good screenplay.
Yeah, or symbolism, or various tonal elements, you can also be scared away. I was in writing classes, and somebody said to me, you know, I don't think this is very good. And I said, why not? And she said, well, it's really almost too readable, isn't it?
Well, we've had some pretty great writers who wrote readable things for popular audiences. Dickens, Dostoevsky, Mark Twain, Thomas Hardy all wrote in magazines and were paid by the word.
Mm-hmm. And Bernard Malamud, one of my favorite writers, was somebody who was a storyteller before anything else.
Now, you last time
Singer,
you were here,
Isaac Beshevis Singer,
yeah,
another one. You know,
great short storyteller.
A guy who was a storyteller before he was anything else.
The last time you were here, you had some problems with your lungs. Is your health okay now?
Yeah.
And were you able to write no matter what happened?
Pretty much. I sometimes think it runs on its own clean circuit, and no matter what's going on physically, God will get me for saying this, but to a point, yeah, when I was here last time, I did your show, I did the National Book Awards, and then I was in the hospital for a month and a half with pneumonia. And getting over that and various hospital-borne infections, one thing and another, I was a sick pup for a while there. But when I was still recovering from that, I started to write a novel called Lisi's Story, which is my favorite of all my books, and I was sick as a dog most of the time I was writing it. But the book doesn't read like the work of a sick man.
Are you reading all the time that you're writing?
Yes.
And are you likely to try to find people you'd never heard of before? Or are you, most of us feel comfortable, we recognize a name of somebody we've really enjoyed in the past. Oh, here's a William Tremper story. I know he's great. Alice Munro or whatever. Or are you looking for new people all the time?
Well, I'm like you. There are writers that I try not to miss because I know that they're going to deliver something that I enjoy. There's Michael Connelly. There's Nelson DeMille. Cormac McCarthy is another one whose work I like. Ruth Rendell. I never miss a Ruth Rendell book. I have writers whose works that I see, you know, lined up on my shelf. I have almost complete collections. The seagoing novels about Aubrey and Maturin helped me with the guys.
O'Brien.
Yeah, Patrick O'Brien. So I love those. But also, if I see a book by a new writer that looks like it would be something that would be interesting, I'll pick that up.
And we have that kind of mix in this collection, The Best American Short Stories of 2007, edited by Stephen King. The series editor is Heidi Pittler, and the publisher is Houghton Mifflin. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure.